super strong, supernatural, and super bad. His punch can topple a skyscraper. His kick can split the earth in two. More destructive than an earthquake. Mightier than a tidal wave. A one-man disaster area.
42nd Street Pete.
Shot full of lead and he still ain't dead. Jump back, Jack, for your skull is cracked.
42nd Street Pete.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Emperor of the North Pole. 42nd Street Pete.
Yeah, well, it's cold enough here to beat a damn North Pole, I'll tell you that. And a message to Punxsutawney Phil and Staten Island Chuck and the rest of those rotten furry rodents that people are actually using to predict the weather with. It better be an early spring or I'm going to skin your furry little butt. You can bet on that. But I can't take the cold. And Todd, you want me to move out to the Midwest and it's colder out there. So guess what? That's never going
to
happen.
Actually, I said we should both move to the West Coast.
That's a possibility, but do you remember about a month ago, I was telling you about this book I read, name of the book was Shadows in Light, it's Journeys with Outlaws in Revolutionary Hollywood.
Yeah.
And it was written by Gary Kent. Now, I usually have a rule of thumb whenever I read a book that if I'm not hooked within the first 20 or 30 pages, it's not going to work. Well, in this case, I was not only hooked, but I was mesmerized by the whole thing because I went through this in one day, dude. I just stopped what I was doing. I just sat down and I just sat there and read this and absorbed it. And what a cast of characters. And it's just a great, great book. And tonight at the Grindhouse, we are honored to have none other than Gary Kent himself, stuntman, actor, and writer here at the Grindhouse for the first time. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Thank you very much, Pete. Now, am I going to need a parka and boots and stuff here for the show, or is it going to warm up a bit?
Oh, it's going to warm up. Come on. I mean, we can actually light one up if you want. You know, I'm good for that.
Now you're talking my language, Pete.
All right.
How are you, my man?
Oh, great, great. I'm. You know, it's been a while. I haven't seen you since we did the Wasteland panel up.
That's been, yeah.
A couple of years ago.
Yeah, for sure.
But I've been there ever since, actually.
Well, where, at the Wasteland?
Yeah, Ken sort of drafted me. I have to go over every show now.
Well, they're beginning to talk about you and Ken. You know that.
Yeah, I know. And Todd knows about it, too. It's horrible. But I actually, you know, with you and Ted Michaels on that panel, it went over so well. You know, we just kept them going.
Yeah, that was a good panel. That was one of the best. I really enjoyed that. That was a good panel. Hey, thank you for those comments about my book. That was very kind of you, and I'll try and have your laundry done and your shoes shined and get them back to you right away.
No, that was from the heart, man, because, like, you know, we're both basically from the same era, and you basically, you know, came from an era of filmmaking that I say was pivotal to American cinema, I'd say from about the mid-60s to the mid-80s. And,
yeah.
You know, you've done it all. You've been with some of the greatest people in front of the camera and behind the camera also.
I'm very lucky. I was just lucky, Pete. But you're right. That was a great era in film. I don't know if we'll see the like of it again or if it's coming back kind of with these kids running around with these new high-def cameras, if they're really going to do some worthwhile stuff or if it'll ever get back, probably not, to that great era of the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Yeah, I know. Everybody says, I want to make a Grindhouse film, and I just turn around and go, you can't because you don't understand the whole mindset of that era because what was done back then, and you know it better than I do, nobody else had ever attempted.
Yeah. Yeah, it was all new ground. That was what was so wonderful about it. And the majors, of course, sort of ignored you because they didn't know what the hell you were doing anyway or what was going on the streets. But we did. You did in New York, and I did out on the coast. And what was going on the streets wasn't what was being put out by the majors. They were still doing Don't Take My Penny, so to speak. And, man, it was guys like Steckler and Al Adamson and Richard Rush and Monty Hellman. Some of those guys just came along and broke it open.
Yeah, I think I think you started around the time with Monty Hellman when he was doing, I believe it was, was it Ride the Whirlwind?
Ride in the Whirlwind and the Shooting, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, two westerns he did up in Utah with Jeff Nicholson.
Yeah, I think also Warren Oates was in that, I believe, too.
Warren Oates, what a guy. Yeah. I love Warren Oates. Yeah, Warren was up there with us. We were up there for a couple, almost 3 months. We had a three-day weekend in between where we all rushed back to Los Angeles and, you know, had a fruit salad and then got back to Utah. We were in Kanab, Utah, Pete, doing those two films.
Yeah, those are two classics. I'm trying to think. Oh, wasn't Harry Dean Stanton was also in there, I believe?
Harry Dean Stanton, yeah, Rupert Cross, Harry Dean, John Hackett, Cameron Mitchell.
Right, I was just thinking, Cameron Mitchell.
Remember Cameron, what a guy.
He was a good actor. Yeah, fortunately, the booze got to him, I think, or something.
Yeah, the booze, and I don't know. What he was such a great guy when I worked with him up there. He was always in a good mood, had a great sense of humor. He was a bit in ill health even then. He had a hard time getting off and on a horse. Even though he wasn't, you know, aged yet, he was sort of beat up. I don't know whether it was from the booze or the life he led or what, but he wasn't in the greatest of health. But mentally, he was just sharp as a tack.
He had done some great stuff, too.
Yeah. You know, what was that thing he did about the fighter? Do you remember?
I remember that, yeah.
He got hooked on morphine or something?
Yeah, that was an old black and white one, I think.
Yeah. Cameron was just great in that. I cannot remember the name of it.
Yeah, now I'm going to be racking my brains. Wait a minute, you know something? Either we do have a computer in front of us or somewhere. Yeah. Maybe, as people are listening to this, I remember the shot of him with his eye busted open and it's still.
Yeah.
Such a good actor. You know, that's the thing too. People don't understand. You don't have guys like you anymore, or Cameron or Warren. You know, they're just not there anymore. They're underwear models.
I know.
The character actors, yeah, they've all been pretty much replaced with these faces that have no character. That's the thing that's driving me crazy. We need the character actors back. I mean, I was just watching The Social Network thinking, you know, this movie is up for an Academy Award. It's supposed to be such a great character study, but you don't see any damn character in it. There's like no characterization in this movie. So I really long for the days of the character actors, and especially the greats.
Yeah. You know, what was great also in those days, you'd go to the set and the stars, I'm going to even mention guys like Gregory Peck, they would show up by themselves, walk on the set by themselves, stop and say hello to the grip, the craft service people. It would take them 20 minutes to get actually on the set just from saying hello to everybody. And then they would leave the same way. Today, they show up with an entourage of bodyguards and publicity people, and they walk right to the set. They hardly say hello to anybody. It's just a different kind of person, in a way. Not all of them, but a lot of them.
That's true. You know, I heard that Woody Harrelson, and from meeting him and hanging with him a little bit, I heard that he was one of the few, and the group that kind of surrounds him, they're all like, man, they drive themselves to the set. They don't need a limo. They got a Bronco.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, Warren, I never saw him need anyone for anything. He'd always drive himself everywhere, you know, walk on the set with his cup of coffee. By the time I met him, Warren couldn't drink anymore. He'd had a bad problem with drinking at one time in his life and pretty well blew his kidneys out. So it was coffee for him, but what a great guy.
I think I found it, Monkey on My Back.
Monkey on My Back. Yeah, and the fighter was Barney Ross.
Barney Ross, Sorry. Right, yeah. Monkey on My Back.
Barney Ross, yeah, yeah. What a good movie that was.
Yeah, so you can learn something on my show, too.
For sure, for sure. One of the great, what you'd call shames of my life, is Cameron was responsible for me learning how to really do stunts, because until Cameron, I was just faking it. I was just falling on my head, not knowing how to really do stuff. And Cameron got me on Daniel Boone, the Daniel Boone TV series, where they had some great, great stuntmen on it. Ted White, Charlie Horvath, some of the really big guys. And Cameron got me on that show, and then I started really learning what to do. And so I always wanted, I thanked him a lot at the time, but in later years when he was really sick and getting ready to go into the hospital, I thought, I've got to go see Cameron and thank him for that Canap, or what he did for me in Canap, and I didn't do it, and it's too late. So it's one of those things that just bothers you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I got a couple like that myself that I, you know, didn't do, and I'm regretting them.
Yeah, yeah. Mercedes McCambridge was another one. What a lady she was, and what a voice she had, Mercedes. But a great lady, and I always said, I'm going to, before it's too late, I'm not going to do a Cameron Mitchell here. I'm going to get a hold of Mercedes, and I didn't do it. So, yeah, I should be doubly thrashed.
Hey, we all make mistakes. It's just, you know, part of life, unfortunately. And
yeah.
We have the regrets.
Yeah.
Was yes. Roy Jensen on Daniel Boone, too? Was it something?
Roy Jensen. I love Roy Jensen. Yeah, Roy passed away maybe 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
But what a great guy he was. At one time, an incredible football player.
He was with the Canadian League?
Right, right. Yeah. And then he went into stunts and acting. And I still remember that fight he did with, I can't see, my mind is gone. Was it Paul Newman? He did this great, great, great fight, movie fight, one of the best I've ever seen. But Roy, yeah, Roy, on Daniel Boone, Roy used to ask me, he'd say, Kent, come here, are you an actor? I'd studied Shakespeare and done a couple of Shakespeare plays. I was very bad in them, but I did them anyway, and Roy found out about it. So every time he did a character or a line, he'd call me over and say, okay, I want you to tell me what my motivation is for doing this. And I always told him, it's your paycheck, Roy. That's your motivation.
He was good. He was a good actor, too, as far as being a tough guy and stuff. He was great at that.
Yeah, yeah. Good family man. He had his wife and kids with him up there in Utah when we were up there. And it teased everybody. You never knew when he was really being serious or being putting you on. But, yeah, I liked Roy Jensen a lot.
Now, I remember something in your book that you you said that the biker films were the films that saved independent cinema?
Well, there's that theory. And between that and the Nudie Cuties, suddenly there was business again. But the biker films from like the mid-60s to the maybe 72, there wasn't a biker film made that lost money. That's a true statement. I mean, they just, for some reason, they sort of replaced the Western. The Western, even on television, wasn't being shown anymore. It was out of fashion. When I first got to L.A., there were all those Western series going. Big Valley, just a ton of stuff. And Cheyenne, Sugarfoot. And all of a sudden, they all disappeared. And so the new hero that came along, or the new Western kind of story, was the biker film. And for some reason, especially in Grindhouse, in independent cinema, people just loved them. Everybody wanted to be a biker. They started walking around wearing collars, wearing biker boots.
Yeah, I remember that. And then getting the shit knocked out of them by the real bikers.
Right, 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 right.
Yeah, that started with the The Wild One was the first one, if I remember right.
Brando, and The Wild One.
That was the template.
Yeah, that sort of introduced everybody to that incident that happened at Hollister, and when they had the big thing. Excuse me. And then we didn't see biker films for a little while, and then all of a sudden they came back again in the 60s.
Yeah, with the Wild Angels.
Yeah.
How many
of them did you watch?
Yeah, I know. I was just going to say, how many were you in? You were in a lot of them.
Yeah, I did 6 or 7 of them at least, and enjoyed them a lot. And I'm not really a biker. And I'm more of a horse guy. I was raised on a ranch. I can do anything on a horse. The bike, not so much. But for some reason, I kept getting cast as a bad guy in a biker film, except one. Al Adamson cast me as a good guy in Satan Sadist, and I played a Marine who does away with the bad guy bikers, the psychos.
Yeah, that was a real popular film going back, because I was managing a drive-in in 72 for the summer, and we were getting a lot of those, a lot of Adamson stuff especially.
Ah. Did you ever meet Al?
Yeah, actually I did, probably a couple of years before that, you know, unfortunately, what his murder. He was a nice guy, you know, very nice guy.
Yeah.
He flew out for a convention in New York. I picked him up at the airport.
Ah. Then you probably know Sam Sherman, too.
Oh, yeah. Sam lives out here.
Yeah.
He's down the Jersey Shore.
Someone told me.
Yeah.
You know, I could be way off here, Pete, but somebody told me that they're getting ready to do the Al Adamson story and that Sam is going to be executive producer. And Johnny Knoxville, maybe direct. Now, I don't know this for sure, but it's the rumor around the loop.
It's possible. I could see Sam as executive producer. That's for sure.
Yeah. So, and then for Al Adamson, the actor, they said that's going to play it is Dan Roebuck. Do you know Dan?
Oh, yeah. Dan's great. He'd be good at that. Dan's really into the stuff.
Yeah.
He's just a regular. He's like you say, he's a regular guy, too. He shows up at the conventions. You can hang around and bullshit with him. He doesn't have that star mentality, you know?
He's a great guy. Great guy, and he loves Al. In fact, the story is, you probably know this, but when Dan left the East Coast to come to L.A. and be a become an actor out there, he had already been in love with Al Adamson movies. He had seen a lot of them as a kid. Now he's on his way. Al owned an inn called the Rimrock in Utah, way out in the middle of nowhere on the edge of the Capitol Reef National Park. And Al had bought this little inn. In fact, he shot a couple of his movies there. But anyway, but it was way off the beaten track. And Dan Roebuck was driving with some pals from New York and taking the long way, you know, just sightseeing on the way. And they ended up at this little inn, the Rimrock. And they went in to get some burgers or something. And they saw all these movie stills on the wall from Al Adamson movies. And this guy was waiting on them. And they said, "Hey, what are you doing with these Al Adamson movies?" And the guy said, "Well, I'm Al Adamson." It floored Dan Roebuck. And to this day, he thinks that incident cemented some kind of psychic relationship with Al, that he has to get that movie done, or else why would he have met him in the middle of nowhere?
That's a theory.
As a kid.
Yeah.
But so
he'd be perfect for it, you know? He really would.
Yeah, he so adores him, and he's tall. And, of course, Al was sort of tall and thin. But Roebuck could be, too. And he'd be good for Al.
Yeah, I wonder who they're going to have play Regina.
Boy, there goes a question for you.
Yeah, really, that's interesting.
Yeah, did you meet her, Regina?
No, I think she he was with, I'm trying to think of the, he was with some woman when he came out, because Regina had passed away. Stevie something?
Oh,
Stevie Ashcroft?
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah, I never met her, Pete. Right. I never met her.
Yeah, I think she was just tagging along for the ride, thinking something was going to happen there.
Yeah, yeah. Before she passed away, Al, once he met Regina, he didn't have eyes for anyone else. All the starlets, so on and so forth, just didn't mean anything to him. It was Regina. That was really a classic love story, flawed as it was in its way. You know, those two. And she was the same way. She was this bombshell who was very friendly, and yet she never cheated that I knew of. There was never even a hint of it.
She was a pretty lady, too.
Yeah, pretty lady, a strange Otra kind of director, making these fantastically weird films, and yet they were like mom and pop with each other. It was great to see, actually.
Yeah. Well, you that we're I'm trying to think. There was also a story. I think you had even told it up at Wasteland about you guys were shooting around the Span Ranch at one point, and Manson was there, and I think it was John Cardos had hired him to fix the Jeep or something.
Yeah, yeah, that was the weirdest thing. Well, Span Ranch, as you know, Charlie Manson and his creepy crawlies, his little gang of people, lived in all these little outbuildings, little shacks that peppered the ranch that George Spahn had. They were all sort of abandoned shacks falling down, and Charlie and the girls moved in under the guise of being, they were going to help with the horses. Spahn was sort of a dilapidated ranch, but he did have a Western Street and a bunch of horses. So a lot of people shot films out there because of, you could go out in the back country and there wouldn't be any telephone poles or anything or TV antennas. So even if you were doing a picture like in the 30s out in the country, even if it wasn't a Western, you were pretty sure that you wouldn't bump into anything modern out there. So it's kind of this dilapidated, weird kind of time warp place. And Charlie and the girls moved in. And one of them, I don't know if this is true, Pete, but one of them supposedly serviced old Charlie, George. George was almost blind. In fact, he was blind.
Yeah, I read that.
Yeah, and so he was really fond of them in his way. But Charlie hardly ever went near George Spahn. He just stayed way out in the out shack, sort of running his group. What would happen is when we shot out there, and I shot five pictures out there, they would always come by at lunchtime and beg food from you. And everybody would feel bad. We'd give them our box lunches or, you know, hey, can we have that cupcake or whatever? And they would send the girls down, and then they would hang around and invite us to parties at night. And none of us ever did, except one time Jody McRae, Joe McRae's son, and Casey Kasem stayed over and went to one of their parties. And the next day they said, oh, man, never again. It was just, not only was it wild, but these people they thought had every, probably, you know, disease you could get. But there they were. They were a very scruffy lot, this group of people Charlie was living with. But yeah, Bud Cardo's, we had a dune buggy, Bud's dune buggy we were using as a camera car, and it broke down, and Bud said, you know, we got to get this fixed, and I was not only acting in it, but I was also production managing. So I said to the girls and a couple of the guys hanging around, that were hanging around too, one of them I liked a lot, Juan Flynn, that Argentine cowboy that was with Charlie. Anyway, they were hanging around, and I said, do you have anybody that can turn me on to a mechanic around here? And they said, we've got a great mechanic. I said, who's that? And they said, we'll go get him, Charlie Manson. So they brought Charlie back, and I just saw this scruffy little guy. He was like 5'5", maybe 5'4", no shirt, barefoot, looked like a shoplifter, had the long hair, but he wouldn't look you in the face. You know, he was always looking down at the ground or off to the side while he talked to you. You'd never get a... I never saw those big hypnotic eyes we saw in the press. I just saw these little shifty kind of eyes. But Charlie said, yeah, I can do this. I need $70 up front, whatever it was, a tie rod or something needed to be. Whatever. And so he said he would fix it, and we came back the next morning, it wasn't fixed. And I said, you'd better get Charlie and get him down here right away. And he came down, and I said, you better fix this, because Bud Cardos is going to eat you a new anus real fast unless this is fixed. And he just, zoom, he had it done. But the interesting thing that happened, Pete, on that film was Tex Watson, who was this weird dude who they keep painting him like he was this normal high school guy from Texas that was an A student that everybody liked. He wasn't. He was like very strange. He's the guy. He may have been okay in school, but he'd have been the one in school everybody was a little leery of, because he just wasn't quite right in the way he thought. And he was wandering around. He always dressed in black, and he would wander around the Spahn Ranch with six guns on his hips and practice fast draws and walk around among the movie crew. And we'd go, who's that guy walking in here with the guns on his hip? And he was always bothering the girls. And so Al told Bud Cardos, get that guy off the set. So Bud went over, and Bud's a nice guy for a little while, if you don't push him too far. And he said, hey, you know, we need you to leave the set. The director doesn't want you here. 5 minutes later, Tex Watson was back, bothering the girls again. And so Bud Cardos just went and grabbed him by the back of the neck and threw him like 10 feet off into the bushes. And Tex Watson went over the hill. About 5 minutes later, we heard all of this gunfire, and that's when the girls told us, oh, yeah, those are real guns with real bullets in them. And Cardo said, I wish somebody had told me that before I threw him off the set.
Holy shit.
yeah, strange group.
Yeah. Well, they're all gone or in jail now, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Excuse me, go ahead.
No, you're the guest. You go first.
I met Krenwinkel. I was sitting, I took my boots off and was emptying rocks. I had some rocks that had gotten down on my boots, and I was sitting on this wooden sidewalk emptying my boots, and out of the sun came this apparition kind of thing, and I couldn't quite see because the sun was in my eyes, but I heard this lovely voice sort of singing and clucking to chickens. She was shooing some chickens in front of her. And when she finally got up where I could see her, it was Krenwinkel, Patricia Krenwinkel, who was one of the killers, one of the group of killers. But you'd have never guessed it. She just seemed like somebody's rather homely cousin that lived on the farm across town where they had a bunch of chickens and sold eggs for a living. I mean, that's what she appeared like to me. And she asked for my lunch, so I gave it to her. But this the murders had already happened, Pete, when we were out there this particular time, although it had been out there before. And, of course, nobody knew it. But yeah, they were already planning on making their escape out into the desert to wherever they went, that other ranch.
That was weird times, too, back then.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
What else did they film out there that you were involved in? Because I remember they had done something. They had done like a female version of the Wild Bunch, the Female Bunch.
The Female Bunch, yes.
Yeah, that's what it is.
I wasn't on that, but I think part of that was shot at the Motel Inn that I told you was mentioning earlier.
Right.
I think they went up there and shot part of it. Yeah, the Female Bunch. Al, one of the good things that women liked about Al is he always had a ton of parts for women where they got to be strong and they got to kick some ass and they got to be petulant and, you know, whatever. It wasn't always just the guys, but women liked working for him because they'd get these juicy parts where they would get to do some pretty wild stuff.
I think you were in that patchwork one he did, Dracula versus Frankenstein.
Yeah.
That was a wild movie.
Yeah, I thought it was over when we first shot it. We shot at Hollywood Stage, this great big stage setup on, I think it was Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood. And a lot of the great independent directors had offices there and would use that stage. Everyone from Peter Bogdanovich to Art Names, who did Snakes, to David Hewitt, to Al Adamson. They all had offices there. Graydon Clark. And that's where I met Lon Chaney Jr., as a matter of fact, was on that picture, Dracula versus Frankenstein. But we shot what I thought was the whole movie there, because I was also the assistant director. I played a very small part in it. But I was also the AD. And we shot this whole story, which I assumed was it. That's it. We're through with the movie. And the next thing I knew, they were off to New York shooting a whole other thing, and they brought Dracula into it, who had nothing to do with the original story. There was no Dracula. But it was like Sam's idea. Wait a minute, we don't really have a complete movie here. They only had like 52 minutes or something. And so Sam and somebody else wrote this whole incident of versus Frankenstein, and as you probably know, it doesn't quite work, and yet there are an awful lot of fans for that movie.
Yeah, it is amazing how many fans it has, because I was a big Lon Chaney Jr. fan growing up, and I remember Famous Monsters gave this thing the big push, and what happened was, for some reason, it didn't come out around here, and then all of a sudden, I'm reading a TV guide that's going to run on Chiller Theater 8 o'clock at night. I'm going, what the hell is this? It never even made the movies? So I'm okay. I still want to see it. So I tune in, and it's not there. And I think that was actually the week either Chaney or J. Carroll Nash passed away. So now I'm working the drive, and I go up there and look at the sheets. I'm like, wow, somebody's getting this movie, but it ain't going to be me. I switched the bookings just so I could see it, and I got fired the next day.
Oh, wow.
That's my memory of the movie. So I was going to leave anyway, but that was beside the point.
Yeah, very strange movie. And you're right, it does have a lot of fans for some reason. Go figure.
Yeah, it's a lot, you know, a lot of those movies like that, you know, like, okay, another one, Hell's Bloody Devils, which makes very little sense.
Yeah, to me either. They held that up for 2 or 3 years until they could find some more footage and put that in. Then they threw a bunch of bikers in. And that's the first Adamson movie I ever worked. And Bud Cardos called me in to do some driving and play a bad guy and get shot, which I did a lot in films. And that's when I met Al. And the cameraman was this young guy from Hungary named Laszlo Kovács, who went on to become a giant, as you know, and as a cinematographer, do some of the great, great stuff. And when Laszlo couldn't make it, there was another guy named Vilmos Zsigmond, who also went on to become a huge cameraman, a big, big star, cameraman star. And Ziggy was always telling the story that one day he couldn't pay the crew, and he was telling Al, I've got to have a paycheck, so on. And Al had not told anybody, but he had a paper route. Al did, and while he was making his movies, and so Al went out and collected from everybody on his paper route and came back and gave the money to Ziggy so he could pay the crew.
And then people want to know why you can't recreate that error.
I know. Yeah. I know. Yeah, another one, Ray Steckler. If Ray Steckler had $1.30... he was going to make a movie with it. And they just don't do that today. They think they do, but they turn the camera on themselves and you know, do me coming of age kind of stories or something. I don't know what it is, but it doesn't have that guerrilla flavor, grindhouse flavor that was so... you could almost smell the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
I think... You mentioned it maybe at the convention when we were doing Cinema Wasteland, and the old grindhouses, you could, you know, not only see the movie, but you could smell it and smell what was under the seats and what was in the theater, and that was part of the charm.
Yeah, and you just don't have it anymore. There's no, it's like I keep thinking, you know, how much it'd be great to bring something like that back. But then where are you going to do it? You know, the few theaters that are still standing are in, like, combat zone areas.
Yeah, I know. Well, Quentin bought the New Beverly Cinema because it was going under. It couldn't keep afloat out in Beverly Hills, and Quentin bought it, and he's showing a lot of independents and some foreign films and some Grindhouse because he's a big Grindhouse fan.
Yeah.
So he does have that going. And then here in Austin, we have a guy named Lars Nielsen who works for the Alamo Theater chain, which is a great, great theater chain, by the way, because they just make cinema fun again. And they put on sing-alongs and everything like in the old days. But Lars is always showing a Grindhouse film or something. They have Weird Wednesday and Terror Thursdays and, you know, all of these kind of things. And midnight, free movies at midnight. And they keep that theater full all the time. But I don't know anywhere else that's doing it. Are they doing it in New York?
No, actually, we were the last guys. I was hooked up with this outfit called Wild Eye Releasing. And one of the owners, Keith Crocker, had an extensive collection of old Grindhouse films. So we were running at this old, actually, it was the only 100-seat theater left in Manhattan down on the Lower East Side. And we called it the Summer of Sleaze. We ran from April up until Halloween night was the last thing. They closed the place down. They wanted $25,000 a month rent to keep it open.
Wow.
Yeah. And the killer part was, We were doing something nobody can do in New York. We were getting people off their asses and out to the theater.
Yeah, I believe you. I believe you. And again, there are people today that I run into. I sort of hang with a local film group here in Austin, a lot of young filmmakers, and they love those movies. And they have a hard time getting them. They get them on video, you know, something weird puts them out or something. Right. And they get them, and they just adore. There's even a Ray Steckler fan club here, if you believe it or not. You know, and if they show it out, excuse me, go ahead.
No, I believe it. Ray has a huge following, actually.
Yeah, the Steckheads. Ray, I wrote the eulogy.
In Austin, there they have these video stores where you walk in and you can actually pretty much find almost anything you want, and that's the thing I like about. Now I'm not sure the name of the stores now because it's been so long since I've been there, but I would go down every summer and visit the Bats at the big bridge there, and I'd go to the video stores right down the street. Man, there's so many of them, and there's a chain just an Austin chain that they've got there, a few of them. You know which one I'm talking about?
Yes, I do, and now I've gone completely blank, because when you said it, the names went right through my head, and then they went right out again. So I can't remember the names, but you're right. There's two stores here.
Yeah.
That maybe more, but two that you can find almost anything in.
It's awesome.
Nothing left like that around here.
There's a couple in Hollywood. There's one out in the valley. Fred something that has, you can get almost any film there. But for it being Hollywood, you'd think they would have masses of archival stores around, and they don't. They've got like one or two at the max.
I tell you, Amoeba Music upstairs there, over near Jack in the Box there, you know, right off Hollywood Boulevard. If you go to Amoeba Music, I tell you, they had a lot of stuff. They had imports from all around the world upstairs there. They had all these Blu-rays and DVDs from pretty much almost anything I would want was there. You know, it was a pretty good selection, but I know what you're saying, though. The real obscures. And I liked Planet Video. Chaz Balin used to take me over to Planet Video when I'd visit him there in L.A. He would drive me over there. Yep, it was a good place.
Yeah. When was the last time you were in L.A.?
It's been about 18 months or 2 years, somewhere in there, something like that.
Ah, boy, it's the whole, I guess it's like Times Square in its way. The whole oeuvre has changed around, you know, since Hollywood Boulevard has, as you approach Highland Avenue, it's gone all day glow, and the Jimmy Kimmel Show is shot there, and just everything is very high tech. You know, a bag of popcorn costs you $8 kind of thing. It's just not like it used to be where you could, you know, for a quarter, you could get a hot dog.
I agree.
Not anymore.
No, but I love the New Beverly. Every chance I get, I go there, hang out with everybody. Last time I was there, I actually had the pleasure of watching Maniac and a couple other movies there with Bill Lustig, who directed Maniac, and a whole bunch. Clu Gulager was there, and Johnny Legend, and we just had everyone hangs out there. It's a brilliant time.
Wow. Yeah, it's a great place, and I'm glad Quentin bought it and saved it. Bless his heart, I don't know what you think of him, but at least he loves film.
I agree.
And he knows, probably you guys know a lot more than I do, but the two people that knew more about film than anyone I've ever known were Peter Bogdanovich and Gary Graver. Remember Gary?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The Hard Road, yeah. He did so many things. Great, great cameraman and a fun filmmaker. And Gary knew every movie that ever been made by anybody, who was in it, who got the coffee, you know, whatever. And Quentin's the same way. I ran into him here in Austin, and we had lunch together. And we started talking about those two Nicholson westerns, Pete, that you and I were discussing at the beginning of the show. And I had said, gee, it's too bad that Jack had written one of those westerns. I said, it's too bad that he doesn't keep writing. And he said, well, he does. He contributes writing to almost everything he does. And then he said, but I sure like the writing and Riding the Whirlwind. I said, so do I. And so I said one of the lines, which was, I don't even want to get started with you today, Vern, which he said to Karen. Next thing I knew, Quentin said the next line of dialogue. Then I said, and we sat there and did the whole movie, just spouting dialogue at each other. He knew every line in the film.
Damn, the only one I can do that with is Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Ah.
That's because it was burned into my brain. Yeah.
Well, you get a lot of creds for that.
Well, you know, it was funny because they used to run that. They used to, for some reason, it was like 2 years in a row when the drive-ins were still going around here. They would run these triples. It would either be Holy Grail, Kentucky Fried Movie, or Flesh Gordon, or they'd throw in the Groove Tube, but it was always Holy Grail in there. So you always wound up seeing that. And it was like, you got to the point you're driving around with your buddies getting stone running lines all the time, you know?
Sure. That's great. There aren't any drive-ins anymore, are there?
There's a few. There's a couple upstate New York, but it's like they're showing Harry Potter, right?
It's not like it used to be. I mean, we have drive-ins here. We got like six here in the Midwest, right here around me. But they're showing the most ungodly. They're completely ridiculous.
Well, back in those good old days that we're talking about, even in Hollywood, you could still, you know, roll up a fat one and go to a regular theater and light it up in the restroom. Because I remember when 2001 came out. That was the thing. Everybody had to drop a tab of Sunshine or something and go see that movie. Everyone thought it was made especially for the acid heads. So we all dropped something and went to that movie, and I remember that it was like a Grauman's Chinese, and the whole theater smelled like it was high. But not anymore. They just, now you have these sort of mini mall kind of things, situations where you go in the theater and there's maybe six people in it, if it's a really good movie, and if it's a really corny, teenage-y kind of thing, it'll be jammed with teenagers all talking and using their iPods. They're not really necessarily watching the movie. They just got away from the folks kind of thing. Yeah. God, you guys are making me homesick for the old days.
I know. I keep doing that. Then reality sits in. I'm like, yeah, where are you going to go tomorrow? You know, there's no place. You know, everybody says, oh, New York. And I'm like, there is no New York. Like, I discussed it, or like I even put it over because it's done. I mean, closest is the Lower East Side. They're trying to generify that right about now.
How about Soho? Is that kind of an eclectic place still?
I don't know. It's so-so. The only two places I know that still have that, you know, that ambiance, there's like a stretch in 9th Avenue for like six blocks in each direction between Port Authority. Uh-huh. It's basically locked in the 70s without, you know, the drug addicts. And on the Lower East Side, it's still pretty much the same. But everything else, it's like, it's bright and glitzy.
Ah, yeah.
It was the 18th.
Yeah, Austin is slowly beginning to become that. It's becoming high tech, and as much as I use a computer and whatever, I still kind of hate to see it happen, because Austin used to be a great town. Have you guys been to Austin?
Oh, I have.
A friend of mine who lives there, and he tells me it's nice.
I go there about once. I go through there because I go to San Antonio, and I stay in Austin. I go to the Six Flags down there.
Oh, yeah. Well, in the old days, if you remember, this is where Janis Joplin started, and Willie, and Waylon, and the boys, and they used to have these great clubs, blues clubs, Antones, and the Armadillo, and Threadgill's Gas Station, and just these great clubs that you could, you know, walk in, no cover, no minimum, and see Michael Martin Murphy or Waylon Jennings singing away, and that's all gone now. They're all closed. In fact, I was invited to come over and have drinks with Shirley MacLaine recently. She was here doing a movie, and we had a mutual friend. And so I went over to have drinks with her, and she said, "Where is Austin? Where's this Austin that I kept hearing about, that everybody talks about? Because it's not here anymore. You know, it's gone." And I said, You must be, you know, jonesing for the old days of the Armadillo and Janis Joplin and the gang. She said, yeah, where's all that? I said, "Surely that's been gone for 10 or 15 years. And every day they pull down something else and put up a new day glow kind of place."
Yeah, it's getting ridiculous. They're trying to pull something in New York now. No more smoking in a public place.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
New York, who would have thought?
Yeah, not that I smoke cigarettes anymore, but a bunch of other people smoking cigarettes sort of covers up what I'm doing, so, you know, it is a bad thing.
I hear you.
It changed. I hear you. You know, I remember one of the last movies you did, I guess, as far as going into a grindhouse, was this film called The Forest.
Yeah.
It did play on 42nd Street.
Did it? The Forest?
Yeah, I did some research on it because I was sort of married then, and I wasn't going over as much as I used to, so I had to behave myself. But I was having an argument with a guy because the print that they put out in code red, it looked like film, and then I actually ran up to a buddy of mine, and he goes, "Yeah, it was playing on the bottom half of a double bill over there." So, yeah, it actually did play over there.
Well, I'll be darned. Yeah. Well, as flawed as that movie is, and it's flawed, it was made by my buddy, Don Jones. Don used to be a boxer in the old days under the name of Irish Frankie Conway. For some reason, he thought that was a good boxer's handle. So he had about 22 fights, and then his last fight was in Vegas, and he went in, and some black guy just knocked the shit out of him in the first round. He said, "That's it. I'm going into the movies." So Don became a cameraman, and then eventually he started directing his own stuff, all this weird kind of grindhouse things, and The Forest was one of them. But Don and I were good buddies. So he did another one called Girls in Chains, Schoolgirls in Chains, which is out on video now. I think it's probably a better movie than The Forest.
Yeah, but I think The Forest is out of print now, too.
Yeah. Well, the guy, Walt from Code Red, called me. He wants another film of mine. I've got a couple of films I am doing DVDs on, one called The Pyramid and the other Rainy Day Friends, and he wants to handle Rainy Day Friends. And he was talking to me. He has both Schoolgirls and The Forest, and he said The Forest actually did pretty well for them. And I thought, why? And he said, because I thought it was, you know, it wasn't that good a film. You guys know that. But he said it was the favorite sleepover films for 14-year-old girls. That's the film they like to rent and have eight other girls come over and have a pajama party and, you know, misbehave and watch The Forest. So I thought, okay, if it's got a purpose, then good.
Oh, you know what we're going to do then? Right now, I have three copies of The Forest, brand new, still shrink-wrapped. And the next three people that email me at 40deuce, spelled out, at hotmail.com, I'll send them a copy. 40deuce, wow. Not 42, 40deuce, spelled out, at hotmail.com. First three people, and they will come in timed, I'll send you a copy. How's that? In honor of Gary here, because, you know, he's cool, and I have three copies. So
let me tell you, folks, you're going to love it. This is a great movie Pete's giving away.
And you'll see it on eBay for like $499 used, but don't let that sway you.
Absolutely.
Some of this stuff amazes me. A DVD goes out of print. It could be the worst thing in the world, but the minute it goes out of print, it's worth $100.
I know. I'm trying to find one now. I did out at the Spawn Ranch called Lash of Lust, which was a nudie cutie. But I played an old prospector in it, and for once I kept my clothes on, and I just played kind of a good guy, an old duffer with these girls that wandered around looking for gold and the bad guys that cost us. But I did one of the best stunt fights I've ever done in my life in that film, plus a couple of horse falls, and I've always wanted to see it and see how it turned. I got a lot of compliments on that fight. I love stunt work, Pete. I just loved it, and that's my biggest pride and joy are some of the stunt work I did. And I can't find that movie anywhere.
Lash
I don't know what
happened.
Lash of Lust.
I'll see what sometimes I'm good at tracking stuff down. You never know. Lash of Lust. Okay, cool. All right, well, cool. Gary, you have a website or anything? Or anywhere, you know, people get in touch with you or anything like that? Or?
Oh, yeah, please. If I could mention that. It's sure. www.GaryWarnerKent. One word. GaryWarnerKent.com. Gary Warner Kent. And it's a new website, just went up. I talk about my books on there and a lot of stories about the old days and some films and a couple of stills from the old days. Not a couple, probably 40. And I'm very proud of it. We're just finishing it now. This guy named Drew Thomas, a young filmmaker here in town. He and John Herndon, a guy named John Herndon, a producer, have been helping me put together some films that we're going to do this summer, and they helped me do this website. So, you know, check it out. I think you guys would like it.
God, you know, like I said, you've just about done everything, and you worked with everybody. We just pretty much scratched the tip of the iceberg here, but buy the book, anybody who's listening to this, Shadows and Light, Journeys with Outlaws in the Revolutionary Hollywood by Gary Kent. Gary, it was great to have you on. We're definitely going to have you back. And we're running out of time, so this is 42nd Street Pete saying stay sick, and we'll see you next week.
See you guys. Thank you, Pete.
42nd Street Pete's Grindhouse is a production of Jackalope 105 FM.
Do you feel that? Oh. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hate and let it flow into me. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You mother, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You fucker, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Madness is the gift that has been given to me. I can see inside you the sickness is rising. It seems that all that was good has died. Oh no, the world is a scary place. Now that you've woken up the demon in me.
Bobby, will you give it to me?
Two, three, four.
Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You mother, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You fucker, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hate and let it flow into me. Why can't you just fuck up and die? Get down with the sickness. Fuck you, I don't need this shit. I'm down with the sickness. You stupid, sadistic, abusive fucking organ. Down with the sickness. Here it comes. Get ready to die. Get ready to
die.
Come on, we go again, motherfucker, yeah, yeah, yeah. Come on down and see the idiot right here. Too fucked to beg and not afraid to care. What's the matter with calamity anyway? Right, get the fuck out of my face. Understand I can't feel anything. It isn't like I wanna sift through the decay. I feel like a wound, like I got a fucking gun against my head. You live when I'm dead. People equals shit. People equals shit. People equals shit. People equals shit. Come on. Me now, so fuck it. Blood on my face and my hands, I don't know why. I'm not afraid to cry, but that is none of your business. Overdo it, don't tell me you blew it. Stop your bitching and fight your way through it. I'm not like you, I just fuck up. Come on, motherfucker, everybody has to die. People equal shit. People equal shit. People equal shit. People equal shit.
What you gotta do?
People equal shit.
I'm not afraid of you.
People equal shit.
Everything you'll never be.
People equal shit.